I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
To some people, a mosh pit is probably their worst nightmare. To others, it's their kingdom. To me, I want nothing to do with them. They look painful and sweaty, and you lose your glasses. I'm a glasses wearer, so that's still not going to work for me. But if you're not a dedicated mosher, you might be surprised to hear, like I was, that mosh pits aren't just a place for sweaty rock fans to forego the concept of personal space. In fact, there are layers to mosh pit culture. Yes, there is a culture, and moshers are governed by more order and etiquette than you might expect. This is Podcast Playlist. I'm Leah Simone Bowen, and today we're exploring podcasts through the theme of rock and roll. The podcast Dakota Ring is all about unraveling cultural mysteries, and they devoted an episode to the phenomenon of mosh pits. Here's a little bit of that now.
As I understand it, the word mosh comes from a misinterpretation.
James Spooner is an artist and filmmaker behind the Afropunk documentary and music festival. He says the story goes that the term originated in the early 80s with Bad Brains, an influential hardcore band whose members were Black and Rastafari. During a Bad Brains show, the lead singer said to mash down Babylon, which had appeared in a number of old reggae songs, like this one, performed by Leroy King. But the crowd misunderstood the Bad Brains singer.
It's just funny to me, you know, I can assume like a bunch of white kids in the audience hear him say mash down Babylon and like don't already know that phrase and invent a completely new word.
Mashing, or moshing, was born. By the early 1990s, it had spread to the dozens of offshoots of punk, as well as heavy metal and grunge. In 1992, Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit became the biggest song in the world. The video showed people moshing in a dank, dark high school gym. And with that, moshing went mainstream.
I remember being a sophomore in high school, walking into this club and seeing the mosh pit and understanding that these kids have no idea what they're doing. These are a bunch of kids who saw the Smells Like Teen Spirit video and are just bouncing off each other. They don't understand that there are moves.
I have to be honest. Initially, it never really occurred to me that there were moshing moves either. I thought the whole point of moshing was that it was freedom to do whatever you want. But James, a longtime mosher himself, set me straight.
The kids that people notice and are like, enjoy watch dancing, are also just good dancers.
James told me the first time he realized this was in his mid-20s. He was dating a choreographer whose style was rooted in Haitian dance. She invited James to show some moshing moves to her dance group. And in return, the dancers showed him their own similar moves based on West African and Haitian dance. James noticed similarities in other styles, too.
If you go to a Jamaican dance hall, they're doing like the Dutty wine. It looks a lot like headbanging. I've seen stuff in Jamaican dance halls that look more like WWF wrestling than anything I've seen at a punk show, which is why I say the whole world moshes.
Moshing has a whole bunch of other moves. There's the two-step, a syncopated stutter step, There's also windmills, which are all about whirling your arms, and picking up change, which is punching your arms down toward the ground and then throwing your elbows back. Of course, there's headbanging, stage diving, and crowd surfing. There's also the much more nerve-wracking Wall of Death, where the crowd splits in two and runs at each other like they're in Braveheart. That Wall of Death is from a show by the band Lamb of God. But one of the things that James said that most convinced me the mosh pit isn't the chaotic, lawless place I thought was also one of the simplest.
My first show, I went the wrong way in the circle pit and I got trampled. I never did that again. Nobody told me that, oh, the circle pit always goes counterclockwise.
And this is just one of the ways there's some order at work, even if outsiders can't see it.
What always excited me about this space is that there are a lot of unwritten rules to keep it constructive and not actually true chaos. It might look like chaos, but it's not.
Christina Long grew up in the Midwest and has been moshing since she was a teen. She's the co-founder of Black Girls World. It's an organization that celebrates Black women and women of color who participate in heavy music genres. She co-founded the organization with her sister, Courtney, who also loves to mosh.
I'm usually described as a happy-go-lucky, sickly positive sometimes kind of person. And I'm like, if y'all knew the anger I had inside of me that I'm only allowed to express through these rock shows, through music. You need that outlet sometimes when you feel powerless.
But Christina says that doesn't mean they haven't been knocked around some.
I've had my glasses broken. I lost a shoe one time. I had an asthma attack one time. I had a guy get KO'd. He was completely knocked out, stone cold, and he fell on me. But in all those situations, the people around me helped. They didn't just ignore us.
She says this kind of help isn't rare. It's one of moshing's unwritten rules.
Well, the first rule is if somebody falls down, pick them up. If you see someone in trouble, somebody struggling, you gotta help them.
But there's another, less chill rule too.
If you don't want to be in the mosh pit, get the hell out of the way.
Even so, her sister Courtney actually feels safer at concerts where people mosh because the rules are much more explicit and everyone knows what to expect.
I was the most scared, I think, at a Lizzo concert. Some of those people, they were like dressed to the nines in all these sparkly outfits and they were ready to fight about who was closest to the stage. I love Lizzo, but I would go with a friend for some protection.
That was Dakota Ring from Slate. That story was produced and narrated by Katie Shepard. The show is hosted by Willa Paskin. Their team includes Andrea Bruce, Joel Meyer, Derek John, and Merrick Jacob. We had Willa join us to curate an episode of Podcast Playlist a few months ago. If you want to hear it, you can find that in our podcast feed or on our website at cbc.ca/podcast playlist. Janoon is a Pakistani rock band that made waves in the 90s and early 2000s with their genre-bending multilingual hits. They became the biggest rock band in South Asia and achieved international success. It was an unlikely story for the band's frontman, Salman Ahmad. Years before Janoon changed the South Asian music landscape, Salman was just a kid with a guitar. In this episode of the Moth Radio Hour, Salman describes how his love of rock and roll put him at odds with his future, his family, and even the Taliban. Let's take a listen.
There's an old saying in Pakistan which goes like, that whisper in your heart has strength. It may not have wings, but it has the power to fly. I first discovered that whisper around the age of 6. I was born in Lahore, Pakistan. And there was a family wedding, and at family weddings, there always used to be music. So at this family wedding, a Qawwali concert was taking place. Qawwali music is about unity, sacred union, whirling, trance-like rhythms, hand claps, and joy. So as a 6-year-old, what I remember is my aunts and uncles dancing, in a state of bliss, fana, mystical ecstasy, and some of them were throwing money at the musicians. And I thought, that's a pretty good job. But also, I knew as a six-year-old in Pakistan that my career, or what my mother always said was, son, you can either become a doctor or you can become a doctor. That was not for me. Cut to when I'm 11, my father, who worked in the airlines, he came home and he said, I've got a job offer in Manhattan. And so we're moving 8,000 miles away to New York. And so my younger sister and I, you know, I'm going to date myself now. We said, Ronald McDonald, 13 channels of television, let's go. So we arrive, and the first 2 years in my middle school, I'm the only overweight brown Muslim kid, and I have no friends except for TV and radio. Until one day when I was 13 at my bus stop, this kid who went to school with me, Danny Spitz, he went on to play guitar in the heavy metal band Anthrax. He looked at me and he said, Sal, Sal, Sal. Dude, you gotta get cool. And I looked at him and I said, cool? What is cool? So Danny took this red ticket out of his back pocket and he said, dude, if you buy this ticket from me, your life will change. Now, as he was hustling me that ticket, I'm thinking about my conservative Muslim mother who thinks, you know, going out anywhere is, you're going to lose your culture, you're going to lose your religion. Yet the whisper in my heart was whispering loudly. And I said, what is that ticket? He said, this is a ticket to see a rock and roll concert at Madison Square Garden. It's for Monday night. It's the only ticket I have. So I said, Danny, I'll buy the ticket. I took the ticket from him. I went home and I said to my mother, there's this field trip. Entire school is going to Madison Square Garden on this Monday night. And you have to drive me. So my mother looks at me with these silent, skeptical eyes. She says, well, you'll have to dress up. And so on that Monday, I'm wearing a yellow floral shirt, red and white striped pants, a black belt, and shiny black shoes. That's how Pakistani kids went out to birthday parties. And so we drive down from Rockland County into Manhattan, and I said to my mother, three blocks away from Madison Square, just drop me here and pick me up later. And as I walk on the sidewalk, and I'm gonna date myself, there are thousands and thousands of teenagers with torn jeans, peace signs, and expressions which say dazed and confused. So you know where I'm going with this. On the Jumbotron, it says, tonight, live in concert, Led Zeppelin. Now, for me, Led Zeppelin could have been the Bay City Rollers. So I walk in, and after about hanging around in this smoky atmosphere with thousands and thousands of teenagers who had, you know, these blissful expressions, just like at the Qawwali concert when I was 6 years old, the lights go down and these four musicians come up on stage. One of them, the guitar player, Jimmy Page, has this two-headed guitar. He's got dragons painted on his pants. And these laser lights are hitting him. And he picks up the guitar and he goes, dum dum, da da dum dum, da da dum, da da dum dum, da da dum, da 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 dum, da da dum. And all of a sudden, this almighty roar goes up saying, Kashmir! I'm thinking, Kashmir, it's not safe there. Pakistan and India have fought three wars over Kashmir. Yet, in this tornado of guitar, bass, drums, and vocals, and whole lot of love, I my heart whispered very strongly again. And at the end of that show, I said, I want to do that for the rest of my life. And so I go home, and I said to my mother, can I buy a guitar? And she said, well, if you can save up enough money, you can buy a guitar. So I worked as a busboy, Bloville Coach Diner, saved up $237 to buy a copy of a Les Paul. And once I had that instrument, you know, it was my soulmate. I just never, you know, came out of my room, locked myself in, listened to the Beatles, listened to the Zeppelin, Hendrix, Clapton, Beck, and I learned all the blues. And pretty soon, my parents got very scared. One day, a surgeon uncle from Pakistan showed up, and they said, can you go into his room and extract him? So my uncle Anwar comes into the room, and I'm wailing away. And he says, beta, son, what are you going to do with your life? So behind him was this poster of Jimi Hendrix. I said, I want to be like that guy there. So he goes back to my parents and he says, look, if he stays in the States, he's going to become a musician. Send him back to Pakistan now. There is no rock music there. So when I graduated from high school, my family moves back. I'm back in my city of Lahore. But now what's changed is there used to be democracy. But while I was away, a military dictator came into power. It was like having a Pakistani Oliver Cromwell. No celebration, no enjoyment, no gender mixing, no music, especially not guitar music. It was like the kingdom of darkness. And I was in the first year of medical school in Lahore, and I was losing my mind. I couldn't go to any concerts. So one day, I thought of this crazy idea. There used to be this gong show on TV. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to put together a secret talent show. So anybody in my class who can tell a joke, who can juggle, who can do anything or tell, you know, play guitar, can be on stage and have their 10 minutes of fame. So I schemed this whole thing up. It was off campus, 60 of us, and at this show, I'm waiting for the juggler to end so I can get up on stage. I had practiced Eddie Van Halen's Eruption. And I had one accompanying musician with me, a drummer, who had a cymbal, a snare drum, and a bass drum. And I said to him, I said, each time I look at you, just hit the drums really hard. So I go into my solo, and I close my eyes. I'm going to this fast finger tapping this part of the solo, and all of a sudden I hear these screams. And in my mind's eye, 18 years old, I'm thinking, I am the rock star. This is a little bit like Michael J. Fox in Back to the Future. And the screams get louder and louder, and I'm just enjoying myself until I realize that these screams are not of adulation and admiration. These screams are of apprehension and danger. So I open up my eyes, and lo and behold, I see the Taliban. And religious extremists who had heard that there was a den of sin and vulgarity, girls and guys mixing with each other, so they came there with burqas. They threw the burqas on the girls. And one of them, this guy with a crazed look in his eye, came up to me, and before I could process what he was trying to do, he grabbed my guitar, my Les Paul, and he smashed it on the marble floor. My rock and roll dream there, and in a weird way, I also thought, you know, this is complete humiliation because rock musicians destroy their own guitars. Yet he goes to me, if you ever play that thing again, I will shoot you down. And they had guns. And this was also in neighboring Afghanistan. The Soviets were there. So there was a drug culture, heroin, and a Kalashnikov culture which had filtered into Pakistan. So it was this really scary time. And a lot of students were killed for no reason. And the stark choices I had was either to cave into the fear, give up my passion, or follow my heart. I chose to follow my heart. Now, ever since terrorists have hijacked Islam, they've twisted so many things. For example, suicide is haram, it's prohibited, but there's suicide bombing. Killing innocents is prohibited, but they kill innocents. And the word, the J word, the dreaded J word, jihad, which actually means to strive, to lift yourself up, and to lift society up, has been now conjures up these images of violence and extremism. So I decided, while I was in medical school, I was going to wage a rock and roll jihad, a struggle to play my music. And I started several clandestine underground bands in Lahore, two of which, Vital Signs, became the biggest band in Pakistan. And the one I founded, Junoon, which means uncompromising passion bordering on madness, in other words, crazy. That band became the biggest rock band of South Asia. I found myself, thank you. In 2008, I took Junoon to play the first ever rock concert in Kashmir. Despite death threats from militants, I played at the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony, and I'm here to tell you the story at the Moth. Thank you.
From PRX, that was the Moth Radio Hour. This episode was hosted by Tara Clancy. The team also included Jennifer Hickson, Meg Bowles, Sarah Austin Jeunesse, and the story was told live by Salman Ahmad. This is Podcast Playlist. I'm Leah Simone Bowen, and today we're listening to stories about rock and roll. If I told you to imagine a rock concert, what would come to mind? A band on stage, guitars, bass, drums, stained glass windows, rows and rows of pews, a few youth pastors and parent chaperones standing off to the side, making sure that everyone was dancing and leaving ample room for... Okay, wait, that's not what you were picturing, right? It might not sound like a traditional rock concert, but churches are often the venue for a different, hugely influential subset of rock, Christian rock. The PRX podcast, Rock That Doesn't Roll, explores how contemporary Christian music, also known as CCM, shaped the youths of church kids everywhere. One of those kids was named D.L. Mayfield. Their parents ran a church that doubled as a music venue for Christian bands.
The biggest band we ever had come play at our church was Squad 5-0.
Wow.
And the elders gave my parents a ton of for that because they were like, you have let Satan into the building.
Squad 5-0 were a glam punk band from Savannah, Georgia. I saw a few of their shows in the 90s. I am not surprised the church elders were upset. They dressed like Guns N' Roses and often had their gigs at Christian events shut down when the crowd got too rowdy.
But for fans like Brad Onishi, getting rowdy was kind of the point of going to a punk show.
What would happen in these Christian circles is you weren't supposed to get super rowdy. You weren't going to punch people and kick, and there wasn't going to be fist fighting. The idea was very much the idea behind like muscular Christianity and Christians playing sports. Like Christians, yes, go play tackle football, tear that guy's head off, but then, you know, help him get up after you tackle him or say God bless you, right? So in the mosh pit, we weren't trying to hurt each other. We were just sort of, you know, dancing in a way that, let's just be honest, a lot of white kids dance in Orange County, which is by not dancing and having no rhythm. So instead, just running into each other and barreling into each other. And it was a nice way to get aggression out, a nice way to like get your blood pumping and to kind of feel alive a little bit.
I mean, I gotta be honest, church basement hardcore shows are, they're the shit, you know, they're just a whole different level of like of raw and just unfiltered.
Did they allow moshing or?
Oh, yeah. And I think some of these churches don't know what they signed up for. They just see Christian band. Okay. And all of a sudden, like, it's, you know, they're screaming into the mic and, like, everything's as loud as humanly possible. And kids are just flailing their arms like they're possessed by a spirit. And they're like, oh, my God, what do we get ourselves into?
For evangelical Christian kids like Tim and Brad, who are trying to live within the moral restrictions of the youth group bubble, moshing and slam dancing provided a loophole to connect with their bodies.
We couldn't have sex, we couldn't drink, we couldn't cuss. So, you know, let's get out here and just sort of like elbow each other for half an hour, and then we'll pray and thank God and we'll go home. So it was, you know, kind of fun. Now, what we were always looking for was like the church basements with the like local punk band that would actually let you mosh. Because most times there would have been like some youth pastor and some dads who were like, guys, no, you just listen. You can jump up and down, but no barreling into it, you know. So we were always looking for the like that cool Methodist church in Tustin that was like, oh yeah, go ahead, mosh away, buddy. Let it rip.
D.L. Mayfield also found a sanctioned form of freedom through punk rock shows. They'd been so inspired by MXPX that they formed their own Christian punk band.
Like a year after I discovered MXPX, I decided to start my own evangelical pop punk band. And I told my older sister, who was 2.5 years older than me, I said, you're going to be the lead singer. And then I got two guys in the youth group to be the guitar player and the drummer. I learned the electric bass because I was like, sort of pragmatic. That is the instrument nobody wants to learn because it's not sexy or whatever. I'll learn to play bass and then I will start a pop punk band and we will tell everyone about Jesus because people need to know about Jesus. That's what my parents kept telling me. Everybody needs to know about Jesus. Proclaim your faith. I was like, here's an excellent way to do it. And just because of who I was, I thought all these tooth and nail bands, like, I kind of agreed with my mom a little bit. Like, they're really not talking about God enough. But it's what we have, and so I will deal with it, but I will be more evangelical than they are.
DL's band was called Anus United, and they basically played as often as possible at the Fishbowl, the venue DL's parents owned and operated. As the band Svengali, DL told their older sister to play to the gender stereotypes of the male-dominated punk scene and dress like Gwen Stefani for their gigs.
And then I was like, but what about me? Like, I'm not going to dress like that. Like, why would I? And so I cut my hair super duper short and I started dressing like a boy. And I would wear like 2 or 3 sports bras. I would wear band t-shirts, corduroy pants from the old man section at Goodwill. I had a chain wallet. I had spikes. And I started getting misgendered, right, as a boy in some of these situations. And everybody thought it was so funny.
Today, DL identifies as non-binary, but as a teen, they didn't have the language to describe anything beyond male or female. But it turns out performing in an evangelistic punk band actually gave them an opportunity to explore their gender presentation without completely leaving the Christian bubble.
I just told my parents, like, hey, you told me I should be a missionary, right? I'm an intense young girl who wants to tell people about Jesus. And since girls aren't allowed to be pastors, right, I have to be a missionary. Well, I'm going to be a missionary to pop punk youth. And they're mostly boys. And I'm just dressing like them. And so my parents were like, okay, this makes sense to us. And they did get some for, of course, to have a kid dress like a boy for, you know, 3+ years. But for me, I really loved blending into that scene.
In Anus United, they even incorporated DL's gender play into a choreographed cover of MXPX's hit, Chick Magnet. Well, he's a chick magnet, if you know what I mean.
The way the girls just go to him, well, you should have seen. After about like a year of that, my sister, because she was a lead singer, she would start to dedicate that song to me. So I would like be playing the bass line, which is so intense. And I would turn around and it like the whole joke was like girls like to hit on me because I dress like a cool punk boy. And then I would like turn around at the end and haha, actually I'm a girl who can play the bass really. And now looking back, I just think it's so funny and so cute. And like nobody knew what to do with a gender nonconforming person back then. And I really carved out a nice little space for myself and I had some fun for a few years. And I wasn't like totally accepted, but I wasn't totally rejected either.
That was Rock That Doesn't Roll from PRX. The show is hosted by Andrew Gill and Leah Payne. Their team also includes Morgan Flannery, Emmanuel Desarme, Jocelyn Gonzalez, Michael Rayfield, and Courtney Florentine. This episode featured interviews with D.L. Mayfield, Tim Whitaker, and Brad Onishi.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share 2 hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
What do Elvis, Johnny Cash, and Aretha Franklin all have in common? Aside from the iconic music, adoring fans, and good hair, they all took inspiration from Sister Rosetta Tharpe, the godmother of rock and roll.
This train is on the way to glory, this train. Yeah, this train.
Sister Rosetta brought her gospel background to the clubs of New York and then to the world. She became a pioneer of rock music while navigating the music industry as a black woman in the 1940s. She was a powerhouse and an icon, but Sister Rosetta Tharpe's name is often left out of the musical history books. This clip from the podcast, They Did That, tells us about the beginnings of her career.
It's 1938, and New York City is poppin'. Doing her thing on the fame stage of the Cotton Club is Rosetta. She can finally cut loose and explore the reaches of her musical talent. It's thrilling, but the Cotton Club was also a lot to take in for a church girl from the South.
It was modeled famously after idyllic depictions of a mythified, bucolic antebellum South, complete with old plantation-style decorations.
Yeah, if it existed today, it would probably be criticized, to put it lightly. But it was the 1930s, and in those days, there wasn't a hotter ticket in town. Picture women in shimmering short skirts getting tossed in the air to the sounds of blaring horns and jazz piano. And next to all the scantily clad women was Rosetta, rocking on the guitar and belting it out. She wasn't a dainty flower like some of the other girls. She was a powerhouse. She commanded the stage. But off the stage, it was a different story. See, she was playing for a largely white audience in a club that mimicked a cotton plantation. But with it came good money.
So during Rosetta's time at the Cotton Club, where she was making $500 a week, which was incredible for a rockin' black girl from Arkansas who grew up wearing hand-me-down and secondhand clothes, she was a popular attraction, if no other reason, for the novelty value of a black genre-bending gospel act.
Rosetta was being her authentic self on stage and was praised for her talents. For her mostly white and secular audience, this was something they had never heard before. But it came at a price.
She began to popularize gospel music while also earning disdain from within the black church and the black communities.
Gospel singers were expected to sing gospel music in the church. Rosetta was not only performing for a secular audience, she was using music that was meant for God and playing it in a nightclub? That was a big no-no. The community back in Arkansas was shocked to hear that their little Rosetta was singing in a sinful place like the Cotton Club. But what shocked her church also thrilled talent scouts. A big record label agent named Irving Mills saw her act and he offered her an exclusive publishing contract with Decca Records.
So what that meant was basically she would get the rights to her music and her songs. This was very transformative in her step into the secular world.
Rosetta knew what she was risking by making a secular record. Her church-going fans might never accept her again. If she was going to take that chance, she was going to make the most of it. And I've got to say, that first record was a banger. The first song she records with them is called Rock Me, and it becomes a hit. It's mostly just Rosetta and her twanging guitar, but it's electrifying. You can hear the rock flair in her voice. Her explosive belts are filled with attitude. She sounds like she's really giving it to a guy that's done her wrong. It's a rendition of a Tommy Dorsey song from 1937, but she put her own spin on it by replacing the lyrics, "Now won't you hear me singing," with "Now won't you hear me swinging." To swing meant to revel in rhythm, to feel the beat in your body. It was scandalous.
It was literally that small to where people were like, "Oh, I know what this means."
But the best moment of the song comes when Rosetta gets to that chorus. She belts "Rock Me" with a little more oomph than the sweet white Tommy Dorsey.
When she says "Rock Me," just the growl in her voice signaled to people, something's going on here. Something kind of grimy and dirty is happening here.
She might have scandalized the gospel world, but for Rosetta, this was a landmark moment. She was getting to express her most genuine self, her identity as a Black woman of faith, and even her sexuality. And she was getting paid for it. She was bringing these sounds to the mainstream for the very first time. Suddenly, she was booking gigs to perform at the Apollo Theater, Cafe Society, Carnegie Hall, the biggest clubs in New York. By the time she was 25, she was rated one of the finest musicians of her time. She was rich and famous and gospel's first superstar. She spent most of her time in the 40s on the road, headlining shows for Black and white audiences. Long before the Civil Rights Act of the late 60s, the ugliness of segregation was in full effect. And there was no way that Rosetta, even with her fame and adoration, wouldn't have felt it. For Black musicians like Rosetta, that ugliness was felt out on the road, especially when it came to finding a place to crash after shows. You couldn't just pull up to the hotel where white musicians stayed and expect to get a room. There were limited options.
First, they would have to go downtown to see if there was a motel that would take them. And if there wasn't, their next stop would be to a barbershop or a beauty shop to ask Black residents of the town to literally take them into their homes, which they did.
Jim Crow made everyday things like finding a place to sleep or finding a place to eat a meal way more complicated. And racism even showed its grisly face when she went to a fancy dress store in Virginia.
She tried to purchase the clothes with cash. They called the police, arrested her. But when they took her down to the station and realized who she was, all the apologies. She ended up getting the clothes for free.
But Aaron says Rosetta reacted the way a lot of Black folks did in those times, with her head held high.
She didn't really complain about that. I feel like for a lot of Black Americans, it just was what it was. She just kind of did her best and presented herself unapologetically for the world to enjoy.
From Sony Music, that was They Did That. The show is hosted by Takara Small. The team also includes India Witkin, Serena Chow, Tiffany Walker, Jasmine Romero, and Rick Kwan. It featured guest Aaron White. I'm Leah Simone Bowen. Today on Podcast Playlist, we're crowd surfing through stories about rock and roll. Looking for more podcast recommendations? Follow us on Spotify or your favorite podcast app. And if you love the show, please share it with a friend. Sometimes things just don't go to plan. Maybe you hit the curb coming out of the parking lot or forgot your lunch at home. Accidents are a part of everyday life. But have you ever accidentally made an album? Willow Smith has. In this episode of Switched on Pop, the singer-songwriter chats about working with her producer soulmate, her diverse rock influences, and the unexpected process behind her latest album, Coping Mechanism.
Chris Griotti is a bubblegum pop metal sorcerer musical wizard. And we just clicked. There are some people who are meant to be business partners. There are some people who are meant to be siblings. There are some people who are meant to be lovers. And there are some people who are meant to make music. So we got into the studio and we're bouncing off ideas and he's just playing riffs. I mean, I walk in and he's just holding the guitar and he's playing different things. And I'm like, oh, I like that. Maybe a little bit less like this. Maybe put that riff in the beginning. Maybe we do whatever, whatever. And we're vibing really, really strong.
Yeah.
Face to face, just guitar and two people. And then we start putting things in the computer. And once we started putting things in the computer, I was like, okay. I kept on telling him, I'm not making an album. I don't want to make an album. I just want to have fun. Because I had just put out Lately I Feel Everything. And I was just like, I don't really want to do another album so soon. It happened pretty darn fast.
Yeah.
Way faster than I anticipated.
Tell me about that first song.
The first song we did was Why. I was writing. Chris, he was cutting up some drum loops. What's really, really cool is that he has a friend who is a really amazing drummer who sends him a bunch of live drum loops. And so everything is live, which is really, really cool. But then he cuts up the live drum loop.
What is the vibe of Why to you? Like when you're getting out of that room, what are you feeling? What is the emotion that you all conjured in that first day?
Because I didn't really know how it was going to go, I just kind of wanted to not get too deep. I mean, my perception of not too deep is,
I don't want to keep feeling alone. Isolation got me going psycho.
I don't want to keep feeling alone. Isolation got me going psycho.
I just wanna stop asking myself why.
I just gotta stop asking myself why. That sounds like a down chorus, which is something that I had never really done before. I was kind of nervous about it because I was like, oh, people are gonna get bored. Like, but then the verses come and it's like, I just am screaming. When that breakdown happens, well, that's one of my favorite parts of the song. And because everything else was very emotional, that kind of just brings it right into almost like a classic rock metal moment. I still wasn't convinced I was going to make an album, even after we had finished that first song. And then we got together again a couple weeks later. And we made Maybe It's My Fault. It made me rethink everything that I had said before.
Yeah, what changed?
How I like to make albums, I never go into the studio saying, I'm going to make an album, let's go. I never do that. I always am like haphazardly in the studio. Collabing with different people, going in by myself, whatever, whatever. And there's always one song that is the mother of the album. Like for Lately I Feel Everything, Transparent Soul was the mother of that album. From that song was birthed all the other songs. This song just needs to have a bunch of kids, and that's the album. That's how I think about it.
There seems to be some kind of larger truth to that process of being like, I'm just doing this for fun. Something is happening. Do you have to ignore the pressure of the larger project in order for that just sort of magical thing to happen?
Once I have the seed, once I have the mother song, it's all turned into excitement because now I know exactly what I'm doing.
So there's like a switch that flips.
100%. And Maybe It's My Fault was that song. And I was like, wow, this is the mother track. This is the one that I want all of the other songs to kind of take the DNA from.
What is that DNA?
That DNA is
the kick-ass, hard, dark guitars with the unexpected, emotional, and kind of creepy main vocal and harmony.
What role has heavy music played in your life?
I mean, it reminds me of my childhood, weirdly enough. Some of the first concerts I ever went to were metal concerts. It's very close to my heart, and it's just badass. That's really how I feel, to put it plainly. And that was always a vibe that I really enjoyed, with the Deftones. The spookiness of the vocal, I really wanted, and the harmonies even, I really wanted to be inspired by Radiohead. I was listening to a lot of Straight Line Stitch as well. And Killswitch Engage.
In an interview with NME, you said that you'd like to work with Les Claypool of Primus.
Oh my goodness, yes. I was listening to a lot of different things, and I just wanted to kind of put it all together.
Maybe It's My Fault becomes sort of like the parent of the rest of the record. So that song comes along.
Yeah.
What's going on in your head? How do you arrive at, we need to keep doing this and this is going to birth many children?
Because I kept on saying I wasn't making an album. And so then I looked at him and I was like, I think we're making an album. And Chris cracked up laughing and I was like, and I was like, well, here we go again.
That was Switched on Pop from Vox. This episode was hosted by Charlie Harding. Their team also includes Rihanna Cruz, Brandon McFarland, Evan Barr, Jolie Myers, and the guest in that episode was Willow Smith. Nobody embodies sex, drugs, and rock and roll quite like the Sex Pistols. They were a British punk rock band in the 70s, and their partying and antics are just as famous as their music. Among their accomplishments, well, their 1977 single God Save the Queen was the most censored record in British history. Disgraceland is an immersive true crime podcast about the music industry. And in this clip from the show, host Jake Brennan tells us how the Sex Pistols kickstarted the punk movement and their own downfall with a middle finger to the monarchy. Just a warning, this podcast contains mature content that may not be suitable for younger listeners.
Pete Townsend, lead songwriter and guitarist for The Who, one of the biggest, loudest bands in the world, stumbled into the Speakeasy Club in London. He had one goal: to get good and drunk. He'd spent the day trying to figure out why his songwriting royalties were tied up in a bank account that wasn't his. And furthermore, why Alan Klein, the ruthless snake who had screwed the Stones and was busy screwing the Beatles, had the authority to not only keep Pete's money tied up, but pocket his own cut in the process. The math was confusing. Pete Townsend didn't do math. He did maximum rock and roll. To complicate matters, punk rock had arrived in England. Punk was vital. It was relevant. It spoke to the dissatisfied and disaffected youth who struggled at the bottom of the class hierarchy. The Who had once been that band, Pete liked to think, but that was then. 1977 was now. Shit, Quadrophenia was 4 years old, an eternity in rock and roll years. The kids may have been all right, but Pete Townsend sure was not. Steve Jones and Paul Cook, guitarist and drummer for the Sex Pistols, sat on their stools in the speakeasy and watched as Pete got started with pint number one. Jonesy was starstruck. His bandmate, John Lydon, aka Johnny Rotten, talked a big game about how the rock and roll establishment was overrun with dinosaurs who desperately needed to come in contact with a giant asteroid. But Pete Townsend? Are you kidding? There would be no punk rock without The Who. Jonesy would not do what he did, and his band would not have nearly the amount of ferocity and rage and sheer volume if it weren't for Pete's windmill and guitar smashing antics. The songs weren't half bad either, like Substitute, a Who cover that the Pistols have been known to perform. And so, loaded with his own liquid courage, Jonesy made his way over to the Mod Icon and introduced himself and Paul. He may have talked too much, call it nerves or the booze and speed coursing through his bloodstream. He figured he'd jog the geezer's memory with the story about the Bill Grundy show and how the Pistols were unceremoniously dropped from EMI after only a few months and one single. Or about how just a few months after that, in February of 1977, they finally gave their bassist, Glenn Matlock, the boot. Glenn played well enough, probably a little too well if Jonesy was being honest. Glenn wanted to be in a proper rock and roll band, and the Pistols, well, there was just nothing proper about them now, was there? Always taking the and the only reason Glenn laughed his way through that Grundy bit was because he was just as wankered as the rest of them. And then there was the whole God Save the Queen business. Glenn just about lost his mind when he heard John's lyrics to that one. He called John a fascist, said the song made them all look like fascists, which obviously it did not. The Queen was the one in charge of the fascist regime, and her loyal subjects, the ones drowning in poverty who still managed to hang on every word she said and every breath she took, well, they deserved what was coming to them. And that's probably what really scared Glenn, and he just didn't want to admit it. It made John happy, though, because it gave him a reason to finally send Glenn packing. John already had his replacement waiting in the wings. John Simon Ritchie, a.k.a. John Beverly, a.k.a. Sid Vicious. That was a selfish move on John's part. He wanted someone on his side, like how Jonesy had Cook, someone that could stand up to Malcolm McLaren alongside of him. But Sid, the guy was a bleeding idiot. John knew it. Jonesy definitely knew it. Sid thrived on chaos, subsisted on junk. Sure, he had the look down pat, but the bass guitar was just another accessory to him. A safety pin, a ripped swastika t-shirt, something to wield on stage. He couldn't play the damn thing. Jonesy had to teach him, and it was like trying to teach a dog to swing a cricket bat. And not just any dog, but like the dumbest of dogs. Which would explain why it was just easier for Jonesy to play the bass parts on the Pistols' debut album. The album they were in the middle of recording at the moment, Wessex Sound Studios. Jonesy stopped to ask Pete, "You ever record there?" Pete Townsend drained the rest of his pint, narrowed his eyes, and gave Jonesy a look of utter confusion. "Wait," Pete said, "who are you?" Jonesy thought, "Townsend must be off his f-." Jonesy went on, "After the Pistols were dropped by EMI, they set their sights on another label, A&M. And that was in March, shortly after Sid joined. What a disaster. They set up this photo op at Buckingham Palace where the band would quote-unquote sign their contract. They'd all been drinking vodka since the moment the sun came up that day. Jonesy, for one, was hitting the bottle especially hard. Pete could relate to this, right? Get a little of this, Pete. The whole thing was starting to feel stale. Stale, can you believe it? The record isn't even finished yet and it already feels like it's over. The Grundy show was the turning point. If it was ever about the music, it sure as wasn't anymore. Now people are dressing the way the Pistols dress. Someone saw someone else spit at a punk show once, and now everyone's gobbing in everyone's face because they think they're supposed to. And Joe Strummer, that poor sod, got conjunctivitis from some bloke's saliva in his eye. Nothing was shocking anymore. It was routine. And the Sex Pistols were supposed to be outside the system, but they could already feel themselves getting sucked into the system. Just another name on the marquee. So they get all good and pissed on the day they sign with A&M, and the whole way to Buckingham Palace in the limo they argue and fight. John wants to be provocative. Sid wants a fix. Jonesy's tired of taking a back seat to the drama of his bandmates. They go through the charade, the bulbs flash, and then A&M breaks out the champagne. Just what they all need, right? More alcohol. And they get back in the limo and fight all the way back to the A&M offices. Black eyes and blood. Sid's so drunk that he kicks a urinal right off the wall in the bathroom. He was probably the one who threw up in the rubber plant pot in that executive's office. But incredibly, none of this behavior put them in the doghouse with A&M. It was actually something that happened right here in the speakeasy that ended that particular relationship.
From Double Elvis, that was Disgraceland. The show is hosted by Jake Brennan. Their team includes Seth Lundy, Pat Healy, Sean Cahalan, and Matt Baudouin. And that's it for Podcast Playlist this week. If you want to hear more about any of these shows, you can find more information on our website at cbc.ca/podcastplaylist. Podcast Playlist is Ailey Yamamoto, Kelsey Cueva, and Julian Uzielli. Our senior producer is Kate Evans. Our executive producer is Cecil Fernandez. I'm Leah Simone Bowen. Rock on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.